out of these SPACs, there will be a FedEx, an Amazon. There'll be some great company that comes out of this. You just have to assume an 80% failure rate. Now, when I say 80% failure rate, I mean a zero.
Yeah.
Lose all your money.
Right.
Space tourism, when I saw that one come up, I was like, that's a Hail Mary. If you're betting on that, you should expect it to be one in 250.
Yeah.
Now, if you're betting on Joby, I would take it from one in 250 down to one in 50. And that's just what I do for a living, is to make these assessments. It's taken me a lot of pain and suffering to get that skill.
Right, yeah.
Man, there are so many
companies. A lot of lessons learned along the way.
There are so many companies, Lon, that I thought were going to do so much better that went to zero. And there are so many that beat my estimations unbelievably that I would have put behind those other companies. Man, there's so much randomness in this. And the randomness is really the founding team.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Northwest Registered Agent. Starting your business should be simple. With Northwest Registered Agent, you can form your entire business identity in just 10 clicks and 10 minutes. From LLCs to trademarks, domains to custom websites, they've got you covered. Get more privacy, more options, and more done. Visit northwestregisteredagent.com/twist today. Squarespace. Turn your idea into a new website. Go to squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use offer code TWIST to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. And lemon.io. Hire pre-vetted remote developers. Get 15% off your first 4 weeks of developer time at lemon.io/twist.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to This Week in Startups. I'm your host, Jason Calacanis. With me again, Alex Trebek, calling in from Jeopardy. No, it's Alex Wilhelm. He's x.com/Alex. He's in Providence, Rhode Island. We're here in the great state of Texas in Austin with Lon Harris in our studio.
Hey, hey.
Hey, shout out to my friends at Capital Factory for hosting us here.
Yeah.
Shout out.
Let's get to the program. What's in the news here, Lon, Alex?
I did want to start us off by talking about this Blue Origin rocket launch. They sent six women into space.
Oh, it's all six women.
The entire crew is women. This is the first all-female crew to go to space since 1963. The Soviets sent a cosmonaut up, Valentina Tereshkova. In 1963, she went into orbit.
This is a great move by, I tell you, this is a power move by Bezos, because there are very few female astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always been this controversy, like who goes on.
Yes.
And so basically what you're telling me is all these female NASA astronauts who haven't been able to go up have gotten up.
Oh, these were not NASA astronauts. It was Lauren Sanchez, Jeff Bezos' lovely bride.
Fiance.
Yes. Well, it was like a wedding present.
I see. Okay. So she went up with five astronauts.
She went up and had five of her lady friends. Aisha Bo, who is a scientist. Amanda Nguyen, who is also a Nobel Peace Prize nominee and a scientist.
This is great.
Journalist and Oprah friend Gail King.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Film producer Carrie-Anne Flynn and pop star Katy Perry.
Woo! Okay. Katy Perry! Yeah!
All right.
This image went viral of Gail King just before. This is when they were walking onto the spacecraft. And Gail King, she's got a little trepidation. People thought maybe she had agreed. When this was an abstract, like, hey, you want to go to space?
She looks terrified.
Like, yeah, and then when they were walking onto the space shuttle, she's having second thoughts. And then the moment they got back.
Is that Katy Perry vomiting?
No, the moment they got back, this is right when the spacecraft landed, Katy Perry kissed the ground.
Yes.
Okay, so once again, Katy Perry making herself the center of attention.
Of course. Even more, Gail King let us know that as they were attempting re-entry, Katy Perry treated them all to a little song.
The best part was when we got back in our seats after zero Gs, Katy sang, "What a Wonderful World."
She did.
Then
oh,
she
my
said,
God.
"What a wonderful world. I see dreams." Oh, yes.
Because
you're in a spacecraft, you can't get away.
She wouldn't.
It's a command performance. You can't escape.
Wow. I can't think of anything worse.
Just let us enjoy the moment.
Get into space.
We're looking at Earth, the majesty of the cosmos all around you. And Katy Perry's got to be like, hang on. I need to make this moment better.
I mean, wow. I just want to shout out Orlando Bloom. Now we all know what this poor man has to go through. I mean, she just breaks out in song and ruins the flight.
I don't know if it ruined, but I feel like I would have wanted to just appreciate the majesty, the grandeur of being in space.
All right, I'm going to defend Katy Perry here. She's a singer. What did you think she was going to do on the way down? Juggle?
I'm just literally trolling. I mean, you could have just, let everybody enjoy.
It's a lot. It's not just to Katy Perry specifically. Anybody.
This has ruined it for me. Now I don't want to go to space. Okay.
I will take your seat.
A friend of mine and I are going to go up at some point when he's ready to go up. It's, we have a group of four of us that are going to do something similar to this, I think.
Yeah, I feel like that's spitting in the face of our Lord. We're clear. There's no oxygen up there. Like, that's not, it's an inhospitable place for.
All right. Well, here's the thing with the Blue Origin approach. And listen, amazing job to Bezos of getting this stuff going.
I mean, yeah, they're doing it. They got to space. They came back. Everybody's safe and alive at work.
Number one, there's something about his rocket.
What a great moment for feminism this was.
There's a lot going on here. I'll just leave it at that because that rocket, kind of feel like the design of the rocket is a little bit trolling.
Oh, it couldn't look more Wang-like. There's nothing you could do to make it look more like a Wang.
No, it is literally designed.
Yeah.
To evoke a certain, yes, a
phallic image, yes.
Yeah, I mean, rockets inherently look like penises,
sure.
And then this one is designed to just look like a circumcised penis.
Yeah.
If people are curious, this is a new Shepard rocket. I think this is the 11th crewed flight from Blue Origins. They've been doing this quite a lot. This is not, by the way, the new Glenn, which is their big take, you know, cargo to space rocket. This is their, like, space tourism rocket. So, just data points.
I'll just give some credit where credit is due. Absolutely fantastic that we now have a second, you know, really super viable, it seems. I mean, they're a decade behind, but
yeah.
It's viable. It's nowhere near what SpaceX is doing, obviously, but maybe they're 10% of the way there.
It's just kind of interesting, too, that it's sort of a different framing marketing approach. Like, SpaceX is so focused on transporting. We're going to deliver satellites. We're making deliveries to the International Space Station. It's cargo.
Cost per kilo is what they're going
right. And Blue Origin, they're leaning much more into the space tourism. Like, mm-hmm. We're taking celebrities up and we're having these incredible experiences. And I feel like they're kind of branding themselves differently.
Yeah. It was like the Virgin Space, which doesn't seem to have made it.
Right. You know, Galactic was that?
Virgin Galactic.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem to have made it. But, you know, this is entrepreneurship. This is capitalism. Some companies work, some don't. This is great because we've been talking on this program for 14 years about things like VTOLs. Flying cars, right?
Mm-hmm, sure.
We've been talking about space tourism. We've been talking about self-driving cars, Waymo, FSD, the DARPA project. We talk about a lot of these things and that they're coming. Drone delivery of food and burritos.
Sure.
It feels like in the last couple of months, a lot of the stuff that was supposedly coming in the next 10 years is actually starting to land.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Gil King is not getting on a rocket. She's a pragmatist.
Yeah.
No way she's going up first.
No, I feel like she feels like me, where it's like, we're really like, why am I testing the odds here?
You're the laggard's laggard on this approach.
I really don't have a strong desire to go to space. I mean, I'm sure it'd be great once you're up there.
Pull up the early adopter curve. There's a curve that, you know, people in the audience should know if they're founders. And it basically goes, you know, you have the laggards on one side, you have the early adopters on the other. This is Clayton Christensen, like, you know, classic way of looking at the adoption curve of new technologies. You have early adopters, you have the vanguard all the way out there, standard deviation. And so when you look at this, you got the innovators, right? It's 2.5% of people. Now, these are astronauts, are innovators, right?
Right.
They're the ones who will come up. They have early adopters. Early adopters will be, you know, right after them. You know, these crazy people who pay $50 million to go on one of these things.
Sure.
And then you have the early majority, the late majority, and the laggards. What we're seeing here is the early majority is doing spaceflight now. These are not early adopters. This early majority kind of behavior.
Mainstream kinds of people.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so the equivalent here would be when you looked at the Tesla rollout, innovators were the ones who bought the Roadster.
Mm-hmm.
Early adopters bought the Model S. The early majority bought the Model X. The late majority bought the Model 3 and Y, and the laggards still haven't bought electric cars. Or maybe they're buying other brands of electric cars or hybrids, right? Like a Prius or whatever. Plug-in hybrid might be the
They're hybrid. The Rivian folks, yeah.
The Rivian folks would be, actually, that's correct. Yes, they would be like the late majority,
right?
I would say. And it's really important to look at that group. Now, when we look at this and we talk about self-driving and Waymos, right now, Waymos is in the early adopters phase. We're not even to the early majority. We only have probably low hundreds of thousands of people who've ever used a Waymo.
Right. And my mom was in town this weekend. Uber offered to send her a Waymo to bring her to Uchi the other night. She said, no.
No bueno.
Oh. Not ready.
Not for mom.
She picked Raphael, the Uber driver, instead.
Right. And she's the late majority.
Yeah.
She might be a laggard.
I mean, she will get there.
So then she's a laggard.
Yeah. On her second or third trip to Austin, I guarantee we'll get her in a Waymo.
So this is this, you know, standard innovation adoption life cycle. If you look at that drone delivery, we're really in the innovators and early adopters.
Right.
We're just going into the early adopters phase.
Founders, if you're serious about raising money, you need to set up your business the right way. Tight is right. And it all starts with having a registered agent. Investors simply won't fund your business if it isn't structured correctly. Before a VC can wire you the first dollar, they're going to check. Is your company incorporated? Is it in good standing and compliant? Missing a filing or losing your status, I mean, it's just going to be a deal breaker for the VC. It's like you're not taking things seriously. And that's what happens during due diligence. That's when a VC makes sure they're not making a mistake by giving you investment dollars. And hey, angels do this as well. And that's where Northwest Registered Agent comes in. For just $39 plus state fees, they act as your registered agent. They handle all the paperwork, they keep you compliant, and they make sure investors see you as a serious business that's worth funding. In just 10 clicks and 10 minutes, your business is officially set up and investor ready. Northwest handles filings, they protect your privacy, and they ensure that you never miss a deadline. These are the chores that you don't want to have to deal with. You need a partner, and Northwest Registered Agent is that partner. Thousands of founders trust Northwest because they keep businesses in good standing. And with their expert corporate guides, you get real support. You don't get bots. You get real people on the phone. So here's your call to action. Very simple, easy peasy, lemon squeezy. Don't let bad paperwork cost you your next funding. Go to northwestregisteredagent.com/twist and get your business investor ready today. For just $39 plus state fees, you can set up your company the right way, fast, private, and compliant. Go to northwestregisteredagent.com/twist today.
There's all kinds of different challenges along that curve. You don't have to convince. Robert Scoble's name was invoked on the last episode.
Yes, it was.
Robert Scoble literally would jump on the hood of a Tesla as an early innovator.
Oh, sure.
Literally, if I was driving my Roadster, he literally would jump on and grab the fender to be part of that. He literally, like, if you had a pill that could increase your IQ, and it was like, yeah, we haven't tested it yet, he's the guy who would just take two and be like, all right, let's test it now. He's that, like, Jack Black he's the Jack Black of the tech industry.
Right.
In a way, where he'll just...
But in the most flattering way.
I mean, in the most flattering way. I'm not describing his body type or anything. unless you're making a visual.
I want to start with a couple of quick things. First of all, Hugging Face, everyone's favorite online repository for AI models and compute, has bought a robotics company, which immediately struck me as kind of confusing because why would a startup that does AI model hosting buy a robotics company? But the company in question is called Pollen Robotics. It's a French robotics company, and they're working on open source robotic technology using AI. So I think the gist here, Jason, is that Hugging Face wants to go from just being the AI hub and source for the digital world and also become the same thing in the physical world. And I think that's freaking genius.
It's a great idea. This company is doing real world robotics. Do you know what format are they?
So this is Ricci 2. And for folks on the audio version, it's a very basic robot with two effectuators, which are little hands. And the gist here is open source research, robotics, and AI. This is not trying to replace a human right now in a manufacturing facility, Jason.
But it is a humanoid robot. It doesn't have legs yet. It's got arms. You know, what's great about this is if the models can have human behavior open sourced into them, the entire industry is not going to be owned by one person, and it's going to move faster. And what AI needs is open source.
Mm-hmm.
When a company is in the lead, they are closed. So ChatGPT and OpenAI closed everything.
Right.
They realized they had a fantastic lead. That's as cynical as it gets. You're committed to being OpenAI, and then you close everything down because you can make money.
Right.
That is the most cynical thing you can do. It's basically like completely dishonest to make that flip. And the actual point of OpenAI was AI is so important that everybody should own it. I actually agree with that.
Yeah.
It levels the playing field, so every person has access to it. Now, when you open the playing field and everybody has access to a technology, that means the business opportunity and the global opportunity is spread equally. If you want to make a competitor to WordPress, you can get WordPress.com, my friend Matt Mullenweg, and you can pay them to host your WordPress blog.
Sure.
You can pay WP Engine, and then there was this other one that I read the ad for. All of those put pressure on WordPress.com.
Right.
They've had a big back and forth with WP Engine. But anybody can use WordPress. It's awesome. Then you look at what's happening in the AI space. Zuckerberg was so far behind. He said, Alex, hey, the great thing to do is let's open source everything we do. That's called Llama. Hugging Face is a collection of all those open source projects.
Right.
Put into one place, a repository, and you can then pop things up. But what's missing is a company like Tesla that's very far ahead. A company that Waymo is very far ahead, self-driving. Are they open or closed?
Close.
Close.
Close. Of course, because they're ahead.
Yeah.
This is what you need to know as an entrepreneur. If you're ahead, do not open anything up. Because all you're going to do is lose fast.
Right.
If you're behind, open up somebody else's clothes. That's what Hugging Face is doing. And by the way, NVIDIA, Alex, you covered an announcement from NVIDIA. NVIDIA announced, Jensen, at his last keynote, that he was going to do an open source and build into the models directly self-driving technology. So now, for every action, there is an equal reaction. You have proprietary language models. That's OpenAI. And I believe Claude. And Grok are all closed.
Right.
And they're the top three, and Gemini's closed. Those are your top four. And now we have on the other side, Llama and DeepSeek, open source. Then we look at self-driving. You have Waymo closed. You have Tesla closed, as they should. I'm not making any judgment here. I'm a pragmatist and an investor. I'm a capitalist. Then on the other side, now you have self-driving by NVIDIA, and you have this real-world robot. For figure AI. To every action, there's a counter reaction. And that is how the game is played. I advised, as did Bill Gurley, Uber to, and I'm advising them again, this is a message to Dara. Whatever you do, the number one focus of Uber right now should be to be support open source self-driving. Why? Why do I, as a shareholder in Uber still to this day, why am I such a proponent of NVIDIA open sourcing what they're doing and this open source movement with Hugging Face? And why do I think Uber should back all open source? Why would I do that?
Because they're behind.
They don't have any bets.
Right.
They are putting anybody into Uber's network. So they have Waymo.
Right.
They have WeRide. They've got a bunch of folks. But if open source technology was used for self-driving, think about how many lives would be saved. I mean, you will pull this technology forward quicker, because then anybody who wants to start an open source company, just like WP Engine and other people wanting to use WordPress, can just start a competitor. What that does is it makes everybody lower prices and move faster, because it's competition. Self-driving open source project would absolutely crush.
Well, it makes the most sense. Like, self-driving is one of those projects that makes so much sense for open source, because it's so much about the data that you're collecting from all these cars on the road. Like, if all these companies were sharing everything they're learning every time they go on these rides, we're going to get where we want to go much more quickly.
More of this is what I'll say. For I think on Friday, we covered those little robots that drive around delivering burritos.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yes. Yeah.
Power move for one of those companies, open source it.
Yeah. Coco and Samo, I think they're called.
Coco and Service Robotics, Jason. Oh my gosh. Serve Robotics. There we go.
Right. Samo is the name of the little guy.
Robotics is ahead. Somebody should make a version of that where all the parts are hardware open source.
Mm.
Actually, this is what DoorDash and Uber Eats should do. They should make a hardware project that's open source for those.
Yeah.
Where you just publish all the specs and let anybody make them. And then you open source the software layer and you open source the data layer. So when you run those robots around Los Angeles, you just publish the data. Just open source, publish world data. There's a project called OpenMap, I think. That's the open source mapping project that was created by Gowalla, Foursquare, and a bunch of other people.
OpenStreetMap.
OpenStreetMap.
Yeah,
because people were fearing the dependency on Google Maps. And then Apple Maps came out. So they have two competitors. And then OpenStreetMap.org is where you can see an open source project. The next thing that should happen is OpenStreetMap plus these little delivery robots plus NVIDIA self-driving. They should all get together and map out the world with LiDAR and make it free for humanity. Now, that could be a bummer for Waymo and a bummer for Tesla.
Yeah, maybe.
Only on the margins, because they have other things that make them defensible, the hardware stack, et cetera. And all it will do is move everybody up the stack to work on harder problems, as opposed to keeping all your data for yourself.
Exactly.
All right, founders, let's talk about your website, huh? It might be a little bit of a sensitive subject. You might be a little embarrassed about it. Let's fix that right now. If you're launching something new, give your brand the refresh it deserves. You're working so hard on your company and your website looks terrible. Do what I do. Use Squarespace. It's the all-in-one platform to make a stunning professional website. And it's ridiculously easy to use. It's going to work for everything. If you're selling products, it's got all that e-commerce built in. If you're selling services, it works perfectly. And they have a new AI product called Blueprint. Want more control? Well, of course, you can choose one of the award-winning templates and use the intuitive drag and drop tools to make it your own. Easy peasy. Squarespace equals the most functional and beautiful website on planet Earth. Go ahead. Squarespace.com/twist. To get a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/twist to get 10% off your first website or domain purchase. That's squarespace.com/twist.
The one other thing I would say about Hugging Face that makes this a really interesting thing for me is when I was working on, like when I was first trying out Stable Diffusion, like during that first wave when everybody was really excited about generative AI and I wanted to try it out, Hugging Face is so essential because that would be where all the little things you want to add, it's like a GitHub for working on those kinds of models where anytime you wanted to add like a Studio Ghibli filter or any other, like make me look like a Barbie doll, any of those, you had to download a new model or a new tweak, a Laura, they call it, from Hugging Face.
Yes.
So it's very integrated into the process. So I think that's what they want to do. Hmm. If you were working on a robotics project, it would be the same thing. Like all the little things, all the little coded details that you wanted to add to your project, you would integrate Hugging Face into your workflow.
One thing I want to bring up before we get too far into the show today is a bit of controversy over the weekend. I don't know where you kind of stand on this one, but Jack Dorsey, formerly of Twitter, formerly of Square, now Block and X, he had a tweet that says he thinks we should delete all IP law. And I'm not exaggerating here. His tweet just reads, delete all IP law. And some people came out vociferously against this. Some people were very much in favor. Hot topic. My dad has a couple of patents. And I don't know. We've talked a lot here about the importance of copyright. Is Jack having a moment? Or is this something that's a bit more of a normal view in technology than I was thinking?
I saw the tweet. I haven't had a chance to respond because I was literally dealing with the fallout from the all-in episode on Thursday, which was the record all-in of all time. It hit number 4 in the rankings. We had Larry Summers on, Ezra Klein on. Sachs came back to do a full episode, and it was wild.
Before you go on, I want to say, Reddit gives me one of the all-in subreddits, just it shows it to me, and you got shout-outs for your moderation skills during that episode in particular. I just wanted you to know that.
Oh, I appreciate that. I have gotten more feedback on my moderation of that episode than the top 5 moderation jobs I've ever did. No, Sachs was like, why am I not allowed to speak? And I wasn't interrupting him. Larry Summers interrupted him multiple times and wouldn't let him speak, which is new for Sachs to experience, because usually people complain Sachs is the one who's interrupting folks. And so I was trying to defer to the guest. Larry Summers, a big guest.
This felt in particular like, I feel like this is actual history. Like in 30 years, when people are talking about this moment,
the tariff moment,
and the reaction to it, because you had this very notable economics expert going head to head against a member of the White House team that is actually
doing
instituting this policy, where it's a rare thing to see.
Doesn't exist in the world.
It's a very rare thing.
I think this was my... It was like a Frost-Nixon moment, wasn't it?
Well, there is that moment where Ezra...
If the president doesn't...
There is that moment where Ezra sort of directly challenges Sachs and is saying...
What are the metrics?
Right. What is the actual goal in real metrics that are measurable, that we can all look at?
And Sachs wouldn't give it to him.
Hedges a bit, and then Chamath kind of tries to step in and save it, and... That to me, it's like, well, that's very notable. Like it's a memorable.
And the notable thing about that is I had said multiple times on the episode, hey, listen, we all know we have to bring back chips. We have to bring back, you know, ships and weapons. We talked to Alex, you and I talked about that on a previous episode, how many ships here. And so, you know, what Chamath described is exactly what the Democrats tried to do in the last.
Yeah, it was mostly the Biden
policy. It is the Biden policy. So you got to give credit there. What Chamath described is what we all agree on and what Biden tried to do with the CHIPS Act.
Right.
And onshoring, I think, chips, rare earths, and you know, some of those and pharmaceuticals. Putting that aside, at the end, I felt like we had some, I tried to bring it back to have a little consensus. You know, there are two other metrics we could look at that I added, which is GDP.
Yeah.
And the number of jobs that work in high tech. So mm-hmm. Alex, just a little homework assignment for Wednesday. I'd like you to share with the audience how many open jobs there are for high tech factory work and how many unemployed people there are who are capable of taking that. And just a general exploration of how many people in America are qualified to do high tech chip manufacturing. And what degree and or skills do you need to do that? Because my understanding is to work in a high-tech factory, we have so few people who know how to do that in America today that TSMC, when they built their fab here, they had to bring people from Taiwan because there weren't any people here.
Really?
I want to try to put some numbers on this and some understanding. What is the reality?
Yeah.
If we want to have 100,000 people working in chip fabs here and doing high-tech chip manufacturing or putting phones together here or routers, what degree do they need to have? What level of precision do they need to have? My understanding is there's like two pieces here. There's like physical dexterity to build some of this.
Look, because it's so small, you're working on something.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a physical dexterity, but also there is some knowledge that you need to have as well. So it's a very hard one for me to understand.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like it's probably, there's got to be different tiers too. I mean, it's a huge team in a big factory. Yeah. I'm sure some of the jobs are more specialized than others.
Okay. So back to the IP recap. I didn't get to do the IP recap, Alex, because I was literally had so many people complaining and congratulating me over the weekend. So back to IP. Jack's a friend. He's awesome. I don't know what part of IP he was talking about here is the challenge. So let's break it down. Did he say anything in the follow-up tweets?
In follow-ups, it looked like it was about AI. Like the only way we are going to compete with the Chinese is if we get over this obsession with copyright. And
yeah, okay. That's what I thought.
That seemed to be where he was coming from to me.
It is when you are a billionaire and you've made all your money in software and building software and you're in the technology industry, you very quickly lose any respect for, if you had any to start with.
Right, yeah.
For artists. In Silicon Valley, people think artists are to be used because artists are so dumb that they've built all these platforms. The platforms aggregate all the value and YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok laugh at how stupid artists are for letting them build $1 trillion, $100 billion, $10 billion franchises off the backs of content creators. Content creators are dumb. And content creators need to show these platforms exactly that they're not dumb. And what they should do is get together, Mr. Beast, I don't know, Charlie XCX, I don't know who the biggest
Colin and Samiri.
Well, they're not huge. I'm saying the ones who actually drive
all the TikTok influencers.
The top 25 TikTok influencers and Mr. Beast and 25 other people should leave those platforms. Now that content is, now that software is so easy to build with AI, they should stick it to them. Leave those platforms and premiere their stuff on their own platform that gives 100% of revenue or 95% of revenue.
It's tough though. I mean, there have been groups that have tried to do this.
Number one.
The Try Guys was a sort of an infamous example. They built up a huge audience on YouTube. You know, the Try Guys, they were on BuzzFeed originally. It was just, they'll go out and try any crazy thing one time.
It can't work with one person. It has to be a consortium of the top 10.
Yeah. Dropout. The College Humor guys went and built their own subscription platform.
Okay, sure.
Their Dropout does okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you need to mix in a record label too, because that way you can get all the music off. If you do, so I feel like right now the reporting circle between music comes out, YouTube ranks of views and revenue kind of goes back in the music industry is a hard thing to break. But I think that would be clutch. So creators, some artists, a record label or two, you could do it.
There's a very simple way to do it, which is, hey, we're going to put 50% of our content on the platform we own. We'll keep 50% on the existing platform. And every time we'll say, watch the follow-up or the behind the scenes at this new place. And if you know, there was a consortium that did that. You could actually teach a lesson to the technology industry. I'm not singling out Jack here. This is like pervasive. Zuckerberg would be the bigger version of this. But Jack himself owns Tidal and he's friends with Jay-Z and Kendrick Lamar. Go ask Kendrick Lamar and Jay-Z if they think that somebody should be able to take their music and put it for free on the internet. right? And then what that would do to the culture if those people couldn't make money.
Right.
And then, you know, I saw Elon retweeted it, and Elon, in fairness, has exposed all of the IP, all the patents for self-driving, for a lot of Tesla's patents. But as we just said in the earlier segment, I don't think the self-driving stuff is open source.
Right.
So people, again, are speaking out of both sides of their mouth. Jack owns Tidal, right? It's still owned by where, I believe?
Block, yeah.
By Block. Okay, if he feels that way, then go to Jay-Z and go to Kendrick Lamar and ask them if they're cool with all their IP being free.
Right.
Okay, founders, let's keep it a buck. Finding the right developers is tough. It's hard, especially when you're trying to run and scale up your startup. You got a lot to do, and Lemon.io is going to save you time. They're going to save you money and a ton of headaches, and they're great at what they do. They've done work to find and vet developers who are experienced, result-oriented, and they charge competitive rates. And you also know that great developers can be hard to find and integrate into your team, so Lemon.io handles all that for you. Startups choose Lemon.io because they only offer hand-picked developers with at least 3 years of experience and who are the best of the best, the creme de la creme. A bunch of launch founders have worked with Lemon.io and they had great experiences. Here's your call to action. Go to lemon.io/twist and find your perfect developer or tech team in 48 hours or less. And Twist listeners get 15% off their first 4 weeks. Stop burning money. Hire developers smarter. Visit lemon.io/twist.
That's the nature of IP. Artists need to be protected. If China doesn't protect IP, I don't like what Sam Altman and Jack and other people are doing here. I think it's dirty. I think it's a really dirty move to say, because the Chinese are thieves, that we're not going to be able to compete. And we, as Americans, should hold a higher standard.
Right.
And I believe this in IP. I believe it in due process. I believe it in many different spaces. You don't get to take the low standard China has for IP or the low standard that El Salvador has for human rights and due process and then apply it to America and say, and point to those bad actors and say, that's what we should do.
Josh Wolf from Lux Capital says, Jack may be smart. This is his stupidest take ever. And I just want to say that other VCs, Jason, are on your side here.
But like I said, I don't understand his intent here exactly, right? And so I have to talk to him first before I actually understand. Sometimes people make tweets and they're, you know, they do have a point. Like, right? He has a choice here. If he truly believes this, Jack has enough money to go buy Jay-Z's catalog.
Right.
Go buy Jay-Z's catalog and open source it and give it as a gift for free to the world and let anybody sample it and use it however they want.
Yeah, he doesn't want to do that.
Okay, let's move on to the next story.
All right. One thing we've been talking about on the show a lot is lack of exits. Jason, in the first quarter of this year, we saw some IPOs. We saw some M&A activity. Yeah, it was going great. Things have changed a little bit in the last couple of weeks. All right. So there's a group called Setter. They're a secondary trading platform, Jason, and they released their Q1 report showing the most in-demand secondary companies. And I wanted to share this to everybody because there's a bunch of Twist 500 companies on here, but also I think it's an interesting look at what VCs are trying to scoop from the secondary markets, which is a key place for liquidity these days. Now, at the top of this list, there are some names you kind of expected, SpaceX, Anduril, Anthropic, but then there are some surprises. xAI ranked higher than I expected it was going to, given its youth. Figure AI, the humanoid robotics company, Jason. Grok with a Q is on there. OpenAI ranks under Stripe with 6th and 7th place. I thought this was a fascinating list.
Anthropic is at $61 billion. Is that the share price or is that the market cap? Let's see. SpaceX, that's market cap.
Last public round, private round that we know of the valuation publicly.
Got it. Okay. EV, expected value? Last round expected value, I think, is what they mean by EV there.
Yes.
So there are tons of these secondary markets. It's kind of like a little bit of gray. There's some weird stuff going on here. And so if we were to look at this, Anduril at $28 billion, SpaceX at $350 billion, and Figure at $39 billion. Figure at $39 billion does not make a lot of sense to me. That's a pre-revenue company, right?
Yep.
So that's the one that stands out. I mean, xAI does have some revenue, and it owns Twitter, so it has billions of revenue there. So that makes sense. Defense Tech, they have billions in revenue, Anduril. SpaceX has billions. Stripe has billions. OpenAI has $10 billion. Grok is crushing it. So when I look at these, the only out of the top 10 that stands out to me here as maybe you would debate is Figure AI. Just so you know how these are driven, secondary markets here are driven not by venture capitalists, but by high net worth individuals.
Right.
And so if you're a high net worth individual, I can go on these and they get pitched on them all the time. And I can buy these, pay massive fees, like typically maybe 5 to 10% to buy them. Oh. And then a 20% carry or 10% carry, or you may just buy them without carry. And when I go buy $1 million worth of Anduril, you know, and I own about 7 million worth of Anduril right now. I'm joking. That's my guy, Bomber Lucky. If you were to go buy $1 million worth of Anduril on this, you're going to pay like $150,000 or $100,000 in fees to get in there.
Wow.
So it's a bit of a racket. A lot of founders don't like this. And they don't like that these markets are doing this because it just creates a bit of chaos for them.
How much of this do you think, because you, like you said, these are not, this is not VC driven. This is just individuals who have the money to throw around. How much of these do you think is driven, rather than based on the fundamentals of the companies, by their notoriety and prominence in the culture? Because I can't help but notice a lot of the companies near the top of the list, they're brands that are recognizable in the world. Your Stripes, your OpenAIs, your ByteDances, your Neuralinks, they're all famous companies.
I would say the panache, the patina, the branding is but 20% of this.
Okay.
It is playing a factor, but a lot of this is cause and correlation. So the reason some of these are famous, like SpaceX and Stripe, is because they've been private for so long. Both of those have been private for well over 10 years now. Those two companies have been private for a long time, which means they have a large number of shareholders. They've got a large number of shareholders because they have so many employees. Employees vest over 4 years typically.
Mm-hmm.
If a company like Stripe is 12 years old, you might have an employee who has had three different grants, a four-year grant, a four-year grant, a four-year grant. Maybe they've had, if it's a really high-performing employee, maybe they have four grants where they overlap. Somebody told me when NVIDIA was private that like Jensen would just drop extra shares on people. He had like a pool of shares that he had like God power on. He didn't have to go to the board or anything. And he would just be like, you did a great job. Boom, I'm doubling your shares. And he wouldn't even do it. He'd have somebody go do it for him.
Nah.
So he was just like dropping these kind of things on people. But there's many, many sellers in these companies because they've been private for so long. A company like Figure AI, they raised this round. And I think Ruloff did a tweet about how SPVs were ruining the industry because there were no lead investors.
Mm.
I think this is kind of a subtweet. I haven't spoken to Ruloff about it. I'm obviously friends with Ruloff. Ruloff, when he said this, at the same time, I was getting pitched on Figure AI at 30, 40 billion. And here's the tweet.
We remain destined to repeat the mistakes of the past. SPVs are making a comeback where the lead investor speaks for less than 10% of the capital, yet eagerly lines up the latest set of tourist chumps who think the story will end differently this time. It's only been 3 years, head exploding emoji.
I think he's talking about Figure AI here. At the same time he made this tweet, people, I understand, were trying to lead Figure AI's round at a reasonable valuation.
Mm-hmm.
Say 10 billion. And listen, this is no shade at the founder of and the team over at Figure AI. They should go for the greatest, you know, valuation they can get.
Sure.
This is their right.
That's
to
their
marketplace.
Job.
However, it is a pre-revenue company. When pre-revenue companies that have serious competitors are raising at a very high valuation, that is going to get the knives out. And it's going to get the more than the knives, actually. You will get a little haters on the margins. The microscopes come out. And
right.
The microscopes today are not the microscopes of yesteryear. It's not a spyglass. This is one of those scientific microscopes, like, you know, at Stanford, that really get in there.
Yeah.
And then you're going to start getting the real colonoscopy going on here. They're going to really examine this company and say, if this company's worth $39 billion, it's pre-revenue, what are the details of this? And they're going to start getting very granular into justifying that. And, mm-hmm. you know, the VCs could be a little upset that some person they consider a knucklehead offers them $40 billion when, you know, let's say Sequoia or Andreessen Horowitz had offered to fund this thing at $20 billion. And they really were going to give them credit. Like, okay, you have zero revenue. my understanding, somebody fact check me, please. I heard they were pre-revenue. Maybe the I think they had a BMW deal.
I have context on that, Jason. Let me share that really quick.
Yeah, please fill me in so I make sure I get my notes correct.
So this is from a story about the $40 billion valuation round that you're referring to and how it's coming together. There's mention in this piece about SPVs, people getting it in for as little as 100K, and essentially what appears to be, from what I can tell, a hunt for capital at that price. But the thing that I wanted to highlight is details are a little bit vague and the company likes to talk. So quoting this Wall Street Journal post, in a March 31 post where he shared a video of the slender humanoids working on assembly tasks for BMW, the CEO wrote, "This isn't a test. This is what autonomous robots in production operations look like." Later, a BMW spokesman said that the automaker had three of the robots at its facility for a technical evaluation. So to me, there does little bit of a disconnect between promise and reality. He's getting a little ahead of his skis, and that makes this entire thing to me a little sketchy. Although I will say, it is a Twist 500 company, so I don't want to be...
Listen, there's no doubt it's a great company. It's no doubt that they are one of the top 10 robotics companies, I think, probably pursuing the space, and they've cashed up. Here's the challenge. We've talked about this countless times. If you oversell something while selling shares, shout out to Nicola, people can consider that to be securities fraud.
Right.
Now, the distance between the two statements you just read us, I will give my judgment. This will be an official judgment. I need to hear the first statement again from the CEO, and I will tell you if this is securities fraud or not.
The CEO, Adcock, wrote, quote, "This isn't a test. This is what autonomous robots in production operations look like. Turn the music up, exclamation point."
Okay. This isn't a test. And BMW said?
BMW spokesman said on April 1, the automaker had three of the robots at its facility for technical evaluation. Quote, "Only one is used at a time, but the robot has practiced picking up and grasping parts during non-production hours in our body shop," the spokesman said. The following week, the BMW spokesman said that he had received an update from colleagues at the plant and that there were now more than three robots on site. He said they were being used in non-production and live production situations.
Pretty close. It's a, wow. This is a bubble case for sure.
This is definitely a bubble case.
Yeah.
Because he said this is not a test. Then the BMW spokesman explains exactly a test.
Yeah. They came back and said, we're using it on both live production and non-production.
And then the last one, he got saved.
Yeah, that's the distinction that really matters.
The final words save him as not guilty. Give me the final words again. The final part of that statement from BMW, the cleanup.
Right. That feels like that was afterwards that they were like, oh, we got to
throw him a bone. Well, no, I'll tell you, they had, not even throw him a bone. When they saw that BMW quote, the lawyers that figure or the lawyers at BMW or somewhere in between, some counsel probably said, wait a second.
Yeah.
Our understanding is this is not a test. You just said it's a test. We're raising money at a $39 billion valuation saying you're our key customer.
Yeah.
Can you please make sure that what you say is accurate in the press? The final sentence.
The following week, the BMW spokesman said that he had received an update from colleagues at the plant and that there were now more than three robots on site. He said they were being used in non-production and live production situations.
Right.
Okay. Now they're in live production situations, which means not a test. So, not guilty. This is not securities fraud. The reason I am harping on this, and I don't want to create another Parle Lucky situation.
No, man.
A CEO is really upset.
Brad Adcock watching this right now, like,
no. Point I'm just trying to make here is a partner can say something out of school, like BMW is their number one customer.
Right.
This raise is happening because of that BMW relationship. When you look at those SPVs, the people investing in the SPVs are investing because they're seeing those tweets from the founder.
Mm-hmm.
If the founder tweets, you know, this is not a test, and the BMW says it is a test, then the person who bought the shares at $39 billion can get a lawyer and then say, hey, I want my money back because you said it wasn't a test. BMW said it is. That is the ultimate way you can buy shares in a company with an option to get your money back, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the BMW person says, no, it's in production, now you have no recourse. The CEO said it's not a test. The person from BMW said, we're not testing it. It's in production. Then you have no case.
Right.
And you have to understand, there are bad actors out there as well. As a founder, there are bad actors who will take every single thing you say on Twitter. And there are lawyers who would be more than happy
to
have a big targeted company with a big valuation and $1 billion or $10 billion in cash, and they will go dunk on them. So just, and if you're taking money from civilians through these SPVs, which is Ruloff's point, to tie both points together, Alex, Ruloff is explaining those people are not making economic decisions the way VCs do, which is to get returns for LPs like Harvard or Ford Foundation or CalPERS and retirement funds. They're not, and sovereign wealth funds, they're not making economically sound decisions at all times. They're making
decisions based on emotions, based on how, as you said, how high profile is the company. So if a founder is out there increasing the profile of the company, which is the job, and you take money from Sequoia or Andreessen Horowitz, they're not going to sue you. They're professionals. They know. They pay. Right. They've done the math. They've penciled it out. They've made a hopefully a thoughtful decision. Civilians are like, YOLO, 100K.
Right.
Then you get 100 YOLOs and you raise 10 million. And then there's five other SPVs doing that same thing.
Right.
Man, this really does complicate things. We run SPVs at thesyndicate.com all the time at a very small scale. The average one is $700,000. We're putting money into seed stage companies, not late stage companies, which is where like the average check size in ours is 7K. Mm-hmm. And you are YOLOing. And we say that. Yeah. Only invest money you can afford to lose. These are typically companies that are either pre-revenue or have a small amount of revenue. Hundreds of thousands a year, low millions. I'm actually in the SPV business as well as the fund business, but primarily the fund business. So yeah, interesting. This is a very interesting situation. Be careful out there, folks.
Yeah.
Be careful out there. And also, I think SPACs and SPVs are things that people should use if they're incredibly sophisticated in very rare circumstances when they make sense, not if you're a dentist.
You know, there'll be, out of these SPACs, there will be a FedEx, an Amazon. There'll be some great company that comes out of this. Mm. These SPACs. You just have to assume an 80% failure rate. Now, when I say 80% failure rate, I mean a zero.
Yeah.
Lose all your money.
Right.
Space tourism, when I saw that one come up, I was like, that's a Hail Mary. If you're betting on that, you should expect it to be one in 250.
Yeah.
Now, if you're betting on Joby, I would take it from one in 250 down to one in 50.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just what I do for a living, is to make these assessments. It's taken me a lot of pain and suffering to get that skill.
Right, yeah.
Man, there are so many
companies. A lot of lessons learned along the way.
There are so many companies, Lon, that I thought were going to do so much better that went to zero. And there are so many that beat my estimations unbelievably that I would have put behind those other companies. Man, there's so much randomness in this.
Yeah.
And the randomness is really the founding team.
I found some fun videos on social media that directly relate to found-up starters. We call these startup insights. I found a really good one this morning from David Heinemeier Hansen, friend of the show.
Oh, DHH.
Our old friend DHH. This is from his a recent episode of his Rework podcast. He talks about the inherent contradictions in being a founder.
So, the inherent contradictions in being a founder. Go.
Let's go in assuming it's going to work. If we're going assuming it might not work, you know what? You're not going to put your all in to it. And if there's anything you need these days, it sure as hell is your all in. Everyone else is putting in their all in, their best thoughts, their best competence, all this stuff into it. You can't show up half-assed and then expect that there's going to be a prize for you. That just doesn't work. And you actually need that conviction, because you're going to have sort of a dip in motivation of like, oh, I think it's not going to work. Oh, this is a great idea. Oh, this is a stupid idea. Like, it's going to fluctuate, right? So you need to go in with that conviction, like whether it fluctuates, whether it go up and go down, I believe this is going to work. And then also, again, knowing it probably won't. It probably won't. And when it then doesn't or does, you're going to be happy either way, because you did it in a way where you did it with integrity, regardless of what that means to you. You're not doing it in a slimy way. You're not doing it in a quick, scammy, make a buck kind of way. You're doing it in a way where you go like, you know what? I could put my name on this. If there was a little box, a little plaque, I'd proudly write, made by David, on it, so people knew who made it. I'm gonna be hiding behind something here. I'm gonna make something I'm proud of, because that's just gonna make me feel good about it. I also think it generally works in the market when you're authentically excited, enthusiastic, and integral about what you're building. And then I'm gonna build it in a way that if it does not work, I'm gonna be better now than I was when I started.
So I thought this was a really interesting sort of insight, and it reminded me a little bit of that Rick Rubin book, the Creative Act, that we like to talk about.
Sure.
Where it's making something that you feel proud of regardless. That's how he recommends getting out of this sort of contradiction, is as long as you are happy with the work that you did and it's something you're proud of and you're happy to put your name on it, it doesn't matter at the end so much whether it works or not. And I like that approach.
Yeah. You know, David's been through the ringer, and he makes a couple of really solid points here that you have to keep in mind. If you're not fired up with enthusiasm, you're going to be fired with enthusiasm, right? It typically refers to employees, but in general, you shouldn't do a project unless you really have that all in. And you notice he mentioned all in many times, like the reason I named the podcast All In, you know, is for a reason. You do need to be dedicated and you need to be all in when you're going for a startup. Why? As he points out, it's a roller coaster. And you do need to recognize I'm going all in with the understanding that there's an 80 or 90% chance of failure.
Mm-hmm.
But no matter what happens, I put my name on the back of it. And Naval was on all in a couple of weeks ago. He sat in the sack seat and he talked about the social network he created for himself. I forgot the name of it. I had it on my phone. They sold it. Spent a lot of time on it. And basically, it was going to be an audio version of Twitter where you have conversations on there and it would be more thoughtful.
Air chat.
Thank you, Alex. And air chat was pretty cool. And he said, you know, he tried. He wanted to do something important in the world. He wanted to feel like he was doing something of substance. You know, he sees Elon, he said, and he feels like pathetic sometimes that he's not making something and he's got to go do something that he really feels. And he put his name on AirChat. He was on it constantly. I had conversations with him on it. And you know what? Social networks are like the lightning in a bottle of all lightning in a bottle. Like you literally put 1,000 bottles out, lightning hits one of them, and the other 999 shatter. And his was one of the 999 that shattered, but he said he felt really good about it. And I think that's one of the things to keep in mind. It's a great quote from David Hammeyer Hansen, friend of the pod.
I just want to say, I really want him to follow me around and kind of keep me in line. I feel like if I ever slacked off, he'd be like, you're not Ellen! All right. Sorry, DHH.
In honor of Jeff Bezos and Blue Origin's big day, we got one more clip here. This is from last year's New York Times Deal Book Summit. And here is Jeff on overestimating risk versus underestimating opportunity.
I think it's generally human nature to overestimate risk and underestimate opportunity. And so I think entrepreneurs in general would be well advised to try and bias against that piece of human nature. The risks are probably not as big as you perceive, and the opportunities may be bigger than you perceive. And the second thing I would point out is that, you know, thinking small is a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, this is something I actually had a conversation with Elon about on his plane 15 years ago. He was working on Tesla and was trying to get a CEO. And he was just saying, people always overestimate the downside risk, was the way he phrased it. That always stuck with me. It is true. If you fail spectacularly, nobody remembers. You remember. You think it's a big deal. You will think about it constantly. It's the equivalent of somebody going to a party and literally trips and falls.
Mm-hmm.
And then they ruminate about that. Rumination, right? And rumination is a real blocker for success in life. Obsessing and ruminating just means thinking over and over again about something. Mm-hmm. And when you ruminate over your perceived failings of yourself, you will then start to feel worse about yourself and you'll over-index on it. And what I have learned is that it's much better to celebrate all of the victories, even the little ones. So we've been sitting here as we build out the studio and I've been celebrating the little victories. Oh, we got the lighting better. Oh, we got the flags up. Oh, we now have this OLED. Oh, we got a better shot over here. Oh, Alex is wearing a collared shirt, not a t-shirt under the blazer. Great. You know, it's just all the little tiny things.
Your perception is that everybody's staring at you constantly and obsessing, yes, over you, but actually no one is ever thinking about you. They're thinking about themselves.
Spotlight syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. And so that is a helpful thing to remember, because I do sort of, you know, I feel like insecure social anxiety, and you just have to get over that because nobody's actually looking at you.
Let's turn this around. So Jason, what you just described is something that I actually personally struggle with. Like, I'm a big ruminator.
Really?
I
didn't know that.
Okay. I'm an insecure introvert. I just pretend. I'm curious about you though. Like, how do you avoid rumination? Like, personally?
Oh yeah. So it was very simple. I am super self-aware, and I've always said, like, I'm a kid from Brooklyn who somehow figured out at a very early age how to start his own magazine and be an entrepreneur because I was unmanageable and nobody taught me anything about entrepreneurship except watching my dad run a bar, which was chaotic. And I built a mythology for myself. And my mythology was, hey, the kid from Brooklyn did okay. I was going to be a cop. The expectations were incredibly low. And my Lord, you know, out of the gate, I started to exceed them. And now I still champion that mythology for myself, which is, can you imagine a kid from Brooklyn became a millionaire, mm-hmm, has everything he always wanted, has a beautiful family, has great friends, and can do whatever he wants in life, has two of the top podcasts in the world, and, you know, gets to ski in Japan. And I take the time to just appreciate how much further I am from the expectation people had for me. And I went into my college counselor, my high school counselor at Severian High School in Brooklyn. This is why I don't donate money to Severian High School. specifically because of this instance and others. And they asked me every year, and in the like famous alumni glass thing they have,
sure,
they have Chris Mullen, mm-hmm. and then somebody told me they had me,
yeah.
and a story about me.
There you go.
Where they, you know, just talk about famous people at my high school.
Yeah,
Severian High School.
You're a notable alumni.
I'm like the number two notable alumni. Yeah, if you look at the people who went there, Chris Mullen, Olympian, incredible NBA player, yeah. J-Cal. Okay, very flattering. I'm still not buying you. They pitched me on building the computer science wing with Jason Calacanis. They asked me for $10 million or something.
Oh, wow.
I've given them $0 for, you know.
Oh, you could have like the Calacanis Memorial Library.
Basically, okay, yes. And cool, I'm yeah. just like, yeah, no. I'm
$10 million?
That's whatever. They wanted
for high school, that
they
feels
literally
like a lot,
pitched
right?
me on doing all this. And, you know, listen, when I went to the person who was the college counselor, I said, they said, well, what are you thinking? And you were required to go twice. That was right. the requirement.
Yeah, no, my school had a similar.
So I went to there, this is when I'm a sophomore or junior, and I said, you know, well, I read about Brown.
Good school.
And in Brown, you can make your own degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really interested in computers, and I'm really interested in psychology. I was wondering if there's anything where you could have like the psychology associated with technology.
What a forward-thinking major that would have been.
This is the age of 15 years old,
yeah,
16
no.
years old. Do you want to know what the guy did? He laughed in my face.
Really?
Yeah.
He laughed at me.
Why?
And he went,
why was Brown super Jason, outside of your, like, what was your GPA?
2 point something. Uh-oh. Yeah, it was terrible.
Yeah, that's a little low.
3, whatever. Anyway, he laughed in my face. He says, there is no way you would ever get in there. Have you taken the police officer's test?
Oh, that's not very nice.
Or the firefighter test.
You should
or,
encourage somebody.
Chips on shoulders, put chips in pockets.
This motherfucker, bleep that. Did not even for a second. He could have just said for but 60 seconds. It's really interesting. Where did you hear about Brown? How did you hear about it? Have you looked into the requirements to get right. to Brown? Is there a second that's, place you could go
right.
that maybe you could do a year or two and then get into Brown?
That's the approach.
Is yes.
What other schools have interesting programs aligned with what you want to study that you could get into and then transfer to Brown?
So he gives me this, you know, this nag, and I just right. thought to myself, and this is when it became J-Cal versus the world.
Well, you know, or it was, did you a favor?
Well, yeah, in a certain way. And I had started to take martial arts and run marathons. And I started to get my chutzpah up. And I was like, you know what? If everybody thinks I'm not going to make it, I'm going to just prove it to them. I got a little, started to get a little chip on my shoulder. And so I went on my own and I figured out, oh, I could go to Fordham University. I knew some friends who were in Fordham, a Jesuit school. And so I started going up, and I my friend was at Fordham, and he was teaching the Taekwondo program there, the Taekwondo club, and I was in the Taekwondo club at Severian High School. So I started going up there every couple of weeks, and I met with this guy. The counsel there was Edward M.J. Boland. I got to find out where he is now. Somebody can find him if they can. I want to send him a gift basket or something, or just say hi to him. And I started going to his office because I had applied for admission to Fordham. And Edward Boland was the guy there. And they sent me a letter and said, you didn't get in. But I had set up a tour with him. And I said to him, hey, I had set up a tour, but you reject him. He goes, oh, well, the tours have nothing to do with the acceptance. You didn't get accepted because we, you know, we have people with higher SATs and higher GPAs. I said, oh, so I can't take the tour even. He goes, no, come up and take the tour. So he met me. He took the tour. I took the tour. I said to him, you know, any chance I can get in, you know, and he said, well, you know, traditionally we don't take a student like you. And I said, well, what about non-traditional? And he looked at me and he's like, that's a good question. I don't know.
Yeah.
And he said, well, where have you been accepted? I said, Brooklyn College. He said, I'll tell you what courses to take at Brooklyn. If you get straight A's and you do really well, then we'll consider you for a sophomore.
Sure.
I said, great. I hammered this guy. I brought him 3 letters of recommendation 3 months in a row, and I dropped them off in his office. I literally went to his office unannounced. Hey, Mr. Boland, it's Jason Calacanis. And he looked at me, he didn't recognize me. He said, I came last month. Remember I had that you guys rejected me at Tobin Brook College? Yeah, yeah. I said, I did really well. Here's my report card for my senior year. And here's a letter of recommendation from a place where I had a job.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, that's great. What are you doing here? He's like, I'm like a Taekwondo thing. He said, oh, you're your friend from the psychology school? I said, yeah. He said, oh, that's great. Nice seeing you. Next month, Mr. Boland. He's like, you're back. I'm like, yes. He's like, another recommendation letter? I said, yeah, I gave it to him. I get a call on August 10th. Never forget it. My mom says, Jason, Fordham's on the phone.
Mm.
I run to the phone. I said, Mr. Boland, hey, how's it going? And I give him a third letter. He said, I never told the story on the air. He said, Jason, I wanted to let you know I'm leaving Fordham University.
Oh, no.
I said,
put in all that legwork. Yeah.
Put in all that legwork. I lost my rabbi. Yeah. He's gone. I said, oh, I'm sorry. What happened? He said, oh, I got a job at Yale.
Mm.
He said, you got a job at Yale? I said, that's a better school than Fordham. He said,
a
I said, congratulations. He said, yeah. And I had one request for Fordham when I was leaving. I said, oh, what's that? He said, I wanted the most promising non-traditional student to get in.
Oh, very
I
nice.
Said, who did you pick? I swear to God, that's what I said. He said, you dummy. I said, what?
You.
He said, yeah, you're in Fordham. I said, I'm in Fordham?
Yeah.
I said, I already signed up for Brooklyn College. He goes, well, you can get in if you want.
Yeah.
I said, okay, what do? He goes, go to the Bursar. Do you want to go to Rose Hill? There's no housing available. Or do you want to go to Lincoln Center? I said, well, I can't afford the housing anyway. Where's Lincoln Center? He said, where's Lincoln Center? You're in New York, right?
Yeah. Lincoln Center.
He says, it's the Lincoln Center. 16th Street. I'm like, oh, famous, Columbus Circle. He's like, yeah, it's place. A block off Columbus Circle. Yeah. He's like, oh, the B train goes there. I have to. He's like, okay. I was like, okay, I'll go to Lincoln Center. I said, what do I do? He goes, go to the Bursar. They got your name there. I said, okay. He said, goodbye. He hung up the phone. I said, Mom, I got into Lincoln Center, whatever. She goes, how are you going to pay for that? I said, I don't know. Figure it out.
Yeah.
I went to Fordham. And that's when I learned that there is a whole system, Alex, out there. And you can either be a victim to the system, or you can believe in the system, or like Neo in the Matrix, you can bend reality. And I decided I would see how far I could bend reality.
Mm-hmm.
It was literally that moment in time. Those two events led me to believe that I could bend reality to what I wanted to be. And it made me so dangerous. Because then I was like, well, I could just start my own magazine. I could just start my own company. I could have Sequoia as an investor. Right. I could do whatever I want. And it just started to snowball. And so once I started to have that mindset that there was a reality available, then like this whole rumination or feeling bad about myself when I did something stupid or I mispronounced somebody's name, I was like, well, who cares? And I just started to view myself as a samurai or a Jedi knight operating in the world as a Ronin. That's where I have my lack of rumination from, is that they laughed in my face and told me I couldn't do it.
Mm.
And then I bent the spoons. And then I just literally in my mind just thought I was a Jedi knight. It is normal for people to think like, okay, what did I do wrong? Why did he laugh in my face? All this stuff. And I realized the reason he laughed in my face is because he's part of the system.
And the system is often wrong.
It's just a system. Like, yeah, the system's wrong. And it's just a system. It's an abstraction. So the whole thing, all of society is just some crazy abstraction. If you want to go to Japan and ski, you can get on a plane with a one-way ticket, go to Japan and start skiing. And I met this guy, John, who owns the Iwanai Resort. He did that. And then he bought the resort. You can just go do things.
Yeah.
He bought Iwanai. Took 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
4 or 5 years to convince the village to let him buy this shut down ski resort.
Yeah.
Now he runs my favorite place in the world, Iwanai. All right, everybody. This has been another exciting episode of This Week in Startups.
Eventful.
Guys, stop ruminating. You just do fucking things. Let's just do things, okay?
That's the deal.
That's it. We'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.